Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and back from assignment is Joel. Last time we had Gina on to replace him, but now back to the old co-host. How does it feel to be back, Joel?
This is a lot better than where I have been. I was taken in to the police station because I found a dead body, and I heard some wild stories, let me tell you. I'll tell you about it later, but I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Pretty good. This is the first time we've spoken since I've been back from Disney World.
That's right. Yeah, you killed a man at Disney World.
Sure, let's say that. He killed himself.
Whoa.
Yeah, we have a guest this time. It's Josh Hollis from PredictoCast.
Yeah, I'm here. I was just waiting, sending in an anonymous tip to the police.
Yeah, so this is a kind of special episode because it's a normal episode / special one because it's Rashomon, probably the most famous Kurosawa movie, and also because there's...
I would say Seven Samurai might be more famous.
Yeah, I think Seven Samurai.
Well, Rashomon is part of the reason we have the Academy Awards included Best Foreign Film category. So
they couldn't resist it, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of that big of a deal. They're like, we should recognize foreign films.
I would say, too, and I think I might have mentioned this on the last episode when we were talking about kind of my experience with Kurosawa, but I feel like Rashomon is maybe... is like very culturally significant because that story structure has been used in tons of movies and television episodes. And I knew about the Rashomon structure of various people giving their points of view of a single event before I had seen the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same here. But so 1950, there's not much to pick from. And the next episode is the one-year anniversary episode, and I'll get into more detail about that at the end. So, this is kind of a one-off, and we kind of... Yeah, there's not much to pick from. There's one Ozu movie from 1950 that is kind of lost. And I'm pretty sure it's gone forever.
That's alright.
Yeah, we're talking... Yeah, Rashomon, if you've been listening to this podcast, you've probably seen Rashomon. It was Kurosawa's like huge breakthrough. He won the silver, was it? That wasn't Cannes. It was like the Venice Film Festival, I think, won the Golden Lion or Silver Lion. And it pretty much made him the international superstar director that he remained for, 45 years?
Okay, this came out in 1950. I mean, he was on the wane in the late 70s, it felt like. It wasn't until back in the mid-80s where everyone started picking it up again. But yeah, this definitely seemed to be the thing that launched him into international spotlight there.
Well, the mid-70s kind of went down, but then Lucas and Coppola gave him money to make Kaganrusha, which you can listen to an episode on our feelings on it. It's that kind of relaunched him.
Yeah, I'm looking at his film, the list of films he made. Let's see, Drunken Angel. It's very appreciated now. That was his eighth movie that he did on his own.
The first with Toshiro.
Right. And after that, he did The Quiet Duel, which I feel bad for talking about that movie negatively because that was like Toshiro's like third or fourth movie. So, but I don't think I was specifically commenting on Toshiro's performance when we were talking about it.
It's just kind of like a weird, almost propaganda sex ed film more than like a movie itself.
Yeah, it's like a drama film that they made like specifically to show to troops after the war. Like, hey, stop getting those VDs.
Yeah, basically.
also drama.
Yeah.
And then, Stray Dog, Scandal. Stray Dog is also highly appreciated now. Yeah. And then we skipped to Rashomon, and that's, you can see. that's where it starts to go Akira, Seven Samurai, Throne of Blood, Hidden Fortress. Woo.
Well, I think I've seen it more than once, but I remember seeing it for the first time it was in a film class when I was in college, so, you know, long time ago. I remembered liking it then, and I enjoyed it this time, though I do have issues with it, not necessarily with the story, but just with the treatment of a particular character. But we can get into that, I guess, as we go through it.
Yeah, that's gonna be a thing to talk about.
Yeah, when I started watching Kurosawa movies, I purposely held off on Rashomon because I knew it was so famous, and I like to start out with the deep cuts when I discover like a new artist, because I don't know, I feel like if you start with a deep cut, it's kind of more interesting that way. And so it took me this was like maybe the 16th or 17th Kurosawa movie I saw, so I was kind of seeing, in my opinion, his better work, and at the time I didn't like it that much. I thought it was just okay, and now I appreciate it more, but still not quite like top tier for me.
Mm-hmm.
I do like it more now than I did before.
This was actually the first Kurosawa movie I saw, I'm pretty sure. I also saw it in the film class that I was taking, and I was irritated by it. I was so irritated by the... Like, when I think back to what I remembered at the time, is I remember the first-person camera interview part. Mm-hmm. And I remember, like, being completely irritated by Mifune because he was acting crazy sometime. Now, in my mind, he was doing that ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha laughing the entire time for some reason. So this time when I watched it, I liked it substantially more than I did. Like, I think it's really good. And I noticed a lot more of the camera work and, you know, the different ways the actors were portraying depending on who was telling the story and stuff like that. And, since I've seen Mifune's earlier work now, I can see how much he's evolved as an actor at this point. And, Kurosawa's style evolving. I really enjoyed it a lot this time. But, yeah, that part, I don't think I even gave it a second thought. The part you were talking about, Josh, when I was in college watching this. And this time I was like, ooh. Like, just when it comes down to physical assault on women, that's a pretty common theme, especially in, like, gangster films.
Yeah.
Like, hey, there's a woman I want, I'm gonna kiss her.
Yeah. I guess, obviously, you know, I also kind of ran into the same situation earlier when I this week when I was watching something that was a little older for another podcast that I was doing a guest spot on. And
whoa.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. You know, you guys are first in my heart, but I gotta get paid. We were watching something that was from 1970, and it still had some moments in it that you can kind of view through a very different lens now and from a 2017 perspective. And I know that a lot of people might say, well, you know, sort of watch it for the time that it's in or the time that it was made or the time that it's depicting, because though this was made in, what, 1949, 1950,
yeah,
it's still depicting a time much earlier than that. I'm assuming, right? Like, I don't think this is set in 1950, so...
Oh, no. This was, like a folk tale that kind of turned into, like, a play, and then it became a book. So it's kind of a thing that just existed in Japanese culture for a long time.
And so, you know, maybe you sort of have to take that sort of thing into consideration, but they still do treat the woman in this movie pretty poorly. In all of the stories, like even in her story, where you might think she's playing it up or might try to make herself out to be a better person, like she's still treated very badly. That was the only part that sort of rubbed me the wrong way, I guess. I liked it overall. I liked the camera work is pretty amazing. Like I guess that part had sort of gone away from my memory from when I'd seen it before. But yeah, it does feel very modern, and it feels very, very fluid and very different from what you would normally expect from a film made in 1950. Like, sort of, if you talk to someone and you say, oh, this movie was made in the 50s, they naturally probably have an idea of what that looks like. And this movie doesn't have that. Like, it's pretty dynamic, especially during the fight scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty dynamic camera, but it doesn't feel, but it also doesn't feel like they don't know what they're doing. Like, it's dynamic and moving, but it's also still in control, and you can still understand what's happening, and the geography makes sense, and you know, and it's kind of interesting that he mastered that in 1950 when we have action movie directors today who can't figure out how to shoot an action scene.
Yeah, well, in Japan, from the, I think starting in the late 19 the late teens, they were doing samurai action movies already. So like the camera work of an action scene was kind of already a known technique in Japanese films, and they were for action cinematography, they were far ahead of everyone else for a kind of a very long time. It took Hollywood until like maybe the 70s to catch up, but like there are several, probably hundreds of silent films that are samurai action films that are shot in a kind of in a similar way.
Mm. It's, I mean, how many before this time have you seen that use that first person point of view, where you're watching the, you know, the person dance around as if he's looking at the other guy with the sword, except for he's, you know, we're at the point of view of the camera instead, because I felt like that was, I've not seen that in an earlier movie personally. It made me think of Any Which Way But Loose, where Clint Eastwood is punching at the camera.
Oh yeah.
Well, and he uses that first person perspective quite a bit, because we sort of get it during the, like, sort of the trial sequences,
mm-hmm.
Where they're just sort of talking to a person, but you can't hear the voice of the judge or the magistrate or whoever it would be that they are talking to. Like, you never hear that. And I would love to, like, take a section of that and then just edit in the Charlie Brown teacher voice over that, because you don't get anything from whoever this sort of legal person is. You just see this character kind of talking and answering questions. It's especially obvious during the bandit sequences, where he's talking about how he did everything and he's answering all these questions, and there's like no real time for anyone to have asked that question, but he's just going, because it's almost like he knows what questions they're going to ask, because he's been in this position so many times before. So he's just going to just rifle off the answers that he thinks they want.
he's doing that old fashioned, I'm answering the phone. What's that? You're looking for my wife. Why, I haven't seen her all day. You know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
What's that? And, oh, the knife?
But yeah. Those scenes feel like a kind of like Spike Lee with the, like a person talking to the camera stuff that he does. And also the, like, as the trial goes on, you see more people like in the background framed a specific way. And it feels very Wes Anderson-esque a little bit too.
Oh, because of sort of like the symmetrical framing and I can see that. I get that. Yeah. It is interesting, because it's like people sort of do the woodcutter and the priest are kind of in the background off to one side during, you know, most of what's going on. And then early on, it feels very kind of small because they're all sort of sitting down. But then once the medium shows up and starts doing her dance around, like it sort of expands in space, and you have a much bigger area than it seems like you do initially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joel, do you know who played the priest?
The priest. I was trying to recognize him.
He plays one of the peasants in Hidden Fortress.
I mean, Everyone plays one of the peasants in Hidden Fortress. Let me see what this guy...
He's a taller one.
Oh, yeah, this guy.
Yeah.
The taller one.
And he's the guy from the Face of Another.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he's the Face of Another guy. He was like, oh, I was taking a bath every time he runs into the character. That guy.
Yeah, I love that guy.
Yeah. And
the woodcutter is our friend from Scandal. Does he always play put upon characters? Like,
I guess every time except for Seven Samurai.
Yeah, I think we maybe even talked about this in the last episode, just like because his demeanor, he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's got this secret that he's holding. He's got, you know, all of these things that he has to deal with and contend with, and he plays it so well. He's just got the perfect face, like this perfect hangdog expression that is always there.
I think Joel knows him pretty well.
Yeah, Josh, you're talking about my father here. Cut it out. No.
Please forgive me.
Even though he does have the weight of the world on his shoulder in Godzilla, I do think he stands a bit, a little more sternly because he's like the professor or whatever.
Yeah, and in Seven Samurai, he's a badass leader.
Yeah, he's the boss in that. That's the only time I've seen him be like, nah, I'm the boss, bitch.
Yeah, kind of only time Kurosawa gave him a role where he got to be in power.
So I have to ask a question. I don't know if this is jumping too far ahead, but the section with the medium when she shows up, like I was trying to figure out and sort of wrap my brain around that, because in one sense it works, because the whole movie is about how people sort of form their own stories and make up things to suit them and lie when it helps their case. But are we supposed to believe that the medium is actually communicating with the dead samurai, or is she just making all of this up and lying? Because it seems like it would make sense for them to believe, oh, she's lying, but then later when they tell the story or when they're talking about it, it seems like they believe that she is getting this message from the samurai who is also lying.
I think for the purposes of the story, you are supposed to believe that the medium is actually tapping into, the dead man's soul or whatever.
Yeah, I would think that too, because Kurosawa, in his own scripts, would never touch a supernatural at all, and this is based off of existing work. So I think
does that mean that the woodcutter is also lying during his story? Because that is presented as if that is sort of the truth. That is the combination of all of the previous stories that we've seen, and this is sort of the definitive tale. But if he is telling the truth, then that means that the ghost was lying about what happened?
No, I think you're right. I think I think the ghost is lying.
Okay. So the ghost is lying about killing himself. Yeah.
He's supposed to be like trying to protect his own image even at the very end, because he's, in some sort of, he says he's in the cold place, oh no, this is why my soul is rotting, because my wife is terrible. This is a movie about how one woman is the worst thing.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. I mean, like I said, that's really my only sour note in the whole thing. Is like, I really liked the convention. I really liked how they told the story, how they sort of laid out the details. It was fun to kind of revisit a setting or kind of a story structure that I'm very familiar with just from all the movies and the TV shows that use it, and see it kind of like the original. I liked all of that, and then, they just treat her so badly. Like, the section in particular with the samurai basically saying, you've been with two men, why don't you go kill yourself? Like, it's just so
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, now I feel like I've seen so many Japanese period pieces that have this, like, representation of one of these women that are above reproach until you actually get to hear them talk, you know? That's like a common trope for some reason. I think you're supposed to assume that most men during this time period are wicked in some way or another, but a woman is either an innocent, you know, cherry blossom, or she's this, you know, devil incarnate that they're pretending that she is, that the woman in this story is sometimes, depending on who's telling the story.
Yeah, I did like, I think one of my favorite parts was the disparity of the fight scene between Tajimaro's example, or like his sort of version of the story, and then the woodcutter's version.
Mm-hmm.
I loved how those things, because even though I can see how, you know, he wants the guy's memory to be sort of restored and be like, well, he fought with me well, you know, we crossed swords 23 times and no other man has ever done that, and like he died valiantly and all of this stuff, and then you find out later that they're both terrified to fight. They both don't know what they're doing. It's very sort of clumsy and rough and scrappy, and you know, and then he kills the guy, and the guy's begging for his life, and like it's a really interesting, I really liked that part a lot, like seeing kind of the difference in what really happened versus what, you know, Tajimura wanted us to believe happened. But then I'm also questioning whether the woodcutter is giving us exactly what happened, because just because he has six kids and he took a fancy dagger to sell to feed them doesn't mean that this guy's above, you know, he's above reproach and he's not going to lie. I'm still kind of turning it over, trying to decide whether I believe the woodcutter's events entirely, or if he is just another filter.
I think he's telling his own version. I think his is probably the most truthful version, but I do think his is still lying. I think he still is lying about some of it. Like, I don't think there is a one truth per se. I don't think the movie presents like a one truthful version. I think it's just literally.
You're right. I think it's just that the priest just seems to believe him wholeheartedly. Like, oh, you're right, and you're also a totally good guy. Now raise this abandoned child.
And so the baby thing. This, for some reason, I remembered it as I thought the common man was going to kill the baby and eat it. But then when I watched it again, I was like, why did I think that?
Why the hell did you think that?
I don't know.
For some reason, I thought he was going to kill the baby, but then I'd watch it in horror the whole time. Like, I hope that scene doesn't come up. And it's like, oh, what am I thinking of?
And maybe that's the original story version?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, but I'd like to bring up that mutual Facebook friend of ours, Megan Dooley, told me about a American remake of this in 1964 called The Outrage that starred Paul Newman playing Mexican in brownface.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's apparently very terrible.
Represent?
And it's on TCM on occasion, according to her.
Okay, interesting.
I kind of want to see it, but I know it'll probably not be worth it.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's one of those things where it's like you sort of have to see a weird thing like that, a weird oddity, even though you know that it's probably going to be bad. It feels like, oh, well, I should see that just because, like, why not?
Yeah, it's like it's a Western, Hollywood Western copy. It's yet another Hollywood Western copying Kurosawa. Yet they kind of took in a weird racist direction.
Well, yeah. I mean, what film is not going to go in a weird racist direction these days?
I don't know. I may have to watch this. It's got Edward G. Robinson and William Shatner in it.
Oh, boy. There's probably going to be no problems with that film.
No, not at all.
All right, so, Joel, do you want to try to synopsize this?
Well, yeah, we can scrape over it. I think we just need to mention a couple of things. So the whole premise is, this is a story where multiple people are telling the story, but the story in the first place is being told from the perspective of this woodcutter played by my father.
Takashi Shimura.
Takashi Shimura, who says that while walking through the woods one day, he was in the lovely, lovely month of May, I guess, he started finding random bric-a-brac as he was walking through. First, a woman's hat with a veil, then something, a couple of other things like a box and stuff like that. And his original story is that he stumbled upon a dead body in a clearing and reported it to the police. And his part of the story is being told at this place that is labeled Rashomon. And it is pouring rain all around them. And him and his priest friend are just sitting there. And they're just both kind of dumbstruck by the whole thing that they've been through together. When somebody runs out of the rain and he's like, "Hey, you guys, you got a story to tell? I want to listen." You know, just some bandit that happened to...
He's Common Man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Common Man. Played by... He's another familiar actor.
Yeah, I can't remember where I knew him from.
Commoner Kuchigiro, what's his name? Kichijiro Ueda. He was in Seven Samurai and Fortress. Yeah, he's been in all kinds of stuff. Oh, The Adventures of Zatoichi. And Scandal.
Okay.
Anyway, so the police had the woodcutter and this priest come in and report what they saw 3 days after the woodcutter found the body of this samurai. And at first, everything is... Well, it's not really like a matter of who's to blame or what, you know, was going on. We just see them kind of relaying their story to the camera as if the camera, as Josh said, as if the camera is... The police officer that's hearing everyone's side of the story.
Yeah, they're like,
which is interesting because
they're telling the audience directly their version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's actually somebody credited as the policeman, although I don't think you actually see this person. It's the guy from Yojimbo, the fat kind of slob guy with the unibrow.
Oh, Daisuke Kato.
Yeah.
I think it's Daisuke. Never mind.
Daisuke
Kato.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's kind of always pudging, playing like goofballs usually.
Yeah. Now, am I right? We don't actually see this guy, do we?
He's the one who captured the bandit.
Oh, he's the guy who's like laughing and be like, "I recognized him because he fell off his horse or whatever."
Yeah, he didn't have ugly, weird makeup this time.
Oh, I didn't realize that was a policeman. I thought it was just a weirdo.
I mean, he looks weird.
Another thing that I thought that, you know, what is Toshiro's Tajimura?
Yeah.
Was telling his story. I could have sworn that he also said that the policeman was the one who murdered the samurai, but maybe I was misunderstanding what the hell he was talking about. But Tajimura has to tell his tale. He's a famous bandit among bandits. As he was, drinking, or he was wandering, that's right. He was sleeping in the forest. He sees a man leading a horse with a beautiful woman on the back of the horse, and, he's just got to... He's got to have it.
Yeah, and he's...
He is the rapist of this movie.
Yeah. He is the only one who actually sees her face.
Well, I assume her husband sees her face.
I mean, the ones who tell the story, because when the woodcutter tells it, I think one of them...
The priest saw him 3 days earlier also.
Yeah, he saw a woman, but he didn't see her face.
Right.
And I think
so. So are we to believe that her face just drives men into insane rages?
Yeah.
I guess.
That's another common trope. That's what happens in Tetsuyo Kaiden, right?
What?
Is it Katsuyo Kaiden? You know what I'm talking about? The ghost story one?
Yes. I know what you're talking about. Yeah, yeah. Kind of.
Yeah, and that's what happens in Under the Blossoming Cherry Trees, which actually has a very similar thing where a bandit sees a woman going through his forest, and he's like, I gotta have her, I'm gonna kill everybody else. And then she turns out to be an evil woman, of course.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if you listened to the Houseu episode with Gina, but I brought up that there's a trend in Japanese horror, even going today from, like, the 40s to now, of when women have power, usually they are a ghost or a demon. So only time women have power in Japanese horror movies is if they're dead.
I see.
Which is kind of a interesting thing I didn't notice before.
That's kind of a thing they point out in here. Like, later, during one of the stories, when the woman actually, it seems like we're getting the truthful version, the woman gets to express herself, she says, I'm a woman, how can I make this decision?
You know, yeah.
That's the position they were back then. Yeah, so when our friend Mifune there is telling his version of the story, he tricks the samurai and telling him he's going to sell him some swords. And he ties him up and runs back to the lady who is down by a stream washing her hands. And at first, he's just going to steal her, you know, have his way with her or whatever. But he's so taken by her beauty, and because he tells her, oh, your husband's fallen sick. And she has this look of pure fear and love on her face that he gets so jealous that he decides to take her back to where her husband is tied up and, do the terrible thing directly in front of him. So, yeah, this is, you know, he's a bad guy. Assault, bad guy. He's trying to talk it up like, ha ha ha, I'm a crazy guy. Of course I can do that, you know? And I think the way this plays out is after he's had his way, he's ready to leave, right? Does he tell her to come with him, or is he just going to leave?
I don't think he tells her to come with him.
Okay, yeah. She says that, well, you can't leave me here. One of you has to die because I can't live with both of you knowing, having this knowledge that I, you know, I'm a soiled woman or something like that. You know, it's an uncomfortable situation, to say the least. So he does what he thinks is the right thing. He frees the samurai, and they have a pretty good back and forth sword fight, filming wise. You know, lots of swords clanging together. It's up there with some of the Seven Samurai stuff, some of the Yojimbo stuff, even when they're actually having real sword fights and not just, you know, the way they usually played out where somebody was probably killed real quick. But eventually our bandit gets the upper hand and he kills the guy. And that's, yeah, we flash back. Or when he turns around, he says that the woman has run off. He doesn't know. He took the other guy's sword and sold it. And, he said, yeah, he's telling the police officer that's interviewing the magistrate or whatever, like, yes, this man, we clashed swords 23 times. The most anyone before me has ever done it was 20 times. So it's very impressive. Ha 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 ha. Is that a good imitation?
It's all right.
While apparently, then we flash back to the rainstorm with our gentleman who's telling the story, the bandit and the priest. And this whole time the woodcutter is saying, you know, like, it's all lies. It's none of it's true. It's all fake. And the bandit's like, well, yeah, of course, you know, I know about that bandit guy. He's going to exaggerate, but that's, you know, that's human nature. That's the way it is. It's like, well, no, we know he's lying because the woman came back. They're like, what? Oh, there's more to the story. So next, we get her perspective. And from, what is her character's name? Masako?
I didn't write down, but it was somewhere.
Masako.
Yeah, Masako.
Played by Machiko Kayo. who was in Ugetsu, Face of Another. And Odd Obsession.
Yeah, she looked familiar, definitely.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's interesting, like, in Ugetsu, I believe she plays a ghost.
Well, let's see. Okay, so he obviously, he paints himself as a pretty, like, bad dude. He just by kissing her, he, you know, seduces her to his side, basically. Because I don't think that he sees himself as assaulting her. Like, I feel like he believes that because he wants to have her, and because he thinks of himself as this great bandit, that she is just, she is overcome with emotion for him, just as he was for her. So I feel like he doesn't see himself as doing that bad of a thing. Like, he sees himself as being, like, he's bad, but also that because he is so bad, she is attracted to that. And then even in the duel, like I already mentioned earlier, like, he still plays up how great the fight was, how great his opponent was. But yet he still bested him. Because even though he was a great opponent, even though this guy's a samurai, like, Tojimuro is still better in every way. And then for the details that don't matter, like, the woman ran off, I don't know what happened to her, and the expensive dagger that the samurai's wife had, I don't know, I forgot about it, because it was a confusing moment. And so it was really dumb of me to leave that behind, but oh well. Like, he's able to sort of sweep away the things that don't paint him in a great light, and then, like, completely cover up and change the things that might make him seem better in some way in his mind.
It is pretty funny how he does seem honestly regretful that he forgot that dagger. Like, oh, that was dumb. I should have got that dagger.
I think the first minute you see him, he's just staring at the sky.
Yeah.
Not paying attention.
They even show the cloud shot because it's like, that's all that's going through his brain. He already knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's like he's shifting into, all right, going to put on a good face and a good story mode.
And he's not the brightest bulb either when it comes down to it. Like we said, when they first find him, he says he got thrown off his horse. Except for his version of the story is, of course, he drank from some water from a stream, and there must have been a poisonous snake dead up there because I fainted. You know, that's slightly more manly.
Yeah, he has a tummy ache because of poison.
Yep.
I drank this poison snake water.
Which I guess that's that really happens. I won't know.
I'm not sure. The way he ends that story is, I couldn't hold it anymore. I assume he means the horse, but it also sounded kind of sounds like he was going to poop his pants.
he's not that kid from Good Morning.
Yeah, well, you know.
I mean, could be his ancestor.
Farting contest. Oh.
Josh, you should see Good Morning. It's really funny.
Yes, you should watch Good Morning.
All right, I'll do that. I'll go on the list.
One of the main plot lines that, well, just watch it. It's delightful.
It's got adorable children, and they do very silly things.
Well, say no more. We'll do it on the show. Say no more.
And the kids, guess what, are not annoying. It's kind of a miracle.
Yeah, it is a miracle. Absolutely. Yeah, another thing that I skipped over is that when the woodcutter is telling his version of the story, that's, I think, some of the most famous camera parts from this movie, because the way the cinematographer does it is we don't, it's not just him like casually walking through the forest and, oh, I found some stuff. We see many different perspectives of him making his way. Like he's on a long journey to get the wood that he's going to collect. And so, you know, we're seeing him, walking towards the camera, walking, you know, the camera following directly behind him. There are shots from the side that pan alongside him, and also stationary shots that move as he moves past. There's ones where he's walking at a height above the camera and we're following him. There is a part where the camera is from his perspective if he was looking up through the canopy at the sun, which I think is like a big deal. For a lot of film history folks.
Yeah, the cinematographer is Kazuo Miyagawa.
Miyagawa.
He's a cinematographer for Ugetsu, Sancho the Bailiff, Yojimbo. He did some Kurosawa stuff, but yeah. He did a Lone Wolf and Cub movie. One of them.
He knows his shit.
Yeah. But yeah, he did Yojimbo and did not do Sanjuro. Anyway, yeah, so this guy's quality.
But yeah, let's cut back to the storytelling. So no one knew where this where the lady was, and I guess she turned herself in after the bandit had been arrested. And in her version of the story, it starts after she had already been violated by Tajimuro. And he's already taken, you know, he didn't want anything to do with her afterwards, so he's already taken off. And she is just talking to her husband and, you know, saying, like, I can't even remember. She's just begging. She's begging for either his forgiveness or for him not to look at her that way.
Yeah.
And the samurai simply doesn't say a word. He simply looks at her. He looks at her in a way like he's disgusted with her. Like, this is all her fault.
Yeah, his look, that very smirky look that he has on his face it's something. I don't know. There's just something about that, like, that very half wry smile that he's got going on. Man, I can understand why she is as freaked out as she is by it.
I mean, like, it is upsetting. I could see, like, if somebody, I don't know, I did, like, yeah, I can't imagine myself in that situation, but that look is just like, I hate you. And there's nothing you can do, nothing that can be done about it. Like, as far as I'm concerned, you're dead to me or something like that, right?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, that actor is in The Bad Sleep Well.
Yeah, he's one of he's another one of the executives. I saw that.
Yeah, and he's in the Zatoichi movie I like the most.
It's Yojimbo meets Zatoichi?
No. Zatoichi goes to the Fire Festival, which has a very, very fun, goofy sword fight in a bathhouse with weird, like, surf rock music played under it.
Those movies are all good. What are you talking about?
And there's a really unfortunate gay character in it that's kind of like, ugh, it's the 70s.
Is he the karate master or one of the karate masters from Sanjiro Sagata 2?
I recognize that name. Yeah, he is one of those. And he's in Tiger's Tail.
He's not the wild-haired one, he's the other one.
Yeah, he's the, I think he's the one who talks.
Not the one who's, like, losing his temper and punching the walls.
Oh, no, no. He's the sane one between the two crazy brothers.
The one that he actually fights with on the snow cliff where he's like,
like, yeah.
Okay, that's where sure I got that from.
Guy. Yeah.
Oh, man. That didn't sound racist. I wasn't trying to be racist. That's what he does in the movie.
Yeah, really. In that movie, he's just crazy, like Bruce Lee sounds.
I'm also calling the police on you, Joel.
Oh, no. Yes, so, and her story, version of the story ends after she faints from not being able to accept how disgusted her husband is with her. And she says when she wakes up, her husband has died, you know, and she didn't see who did it. And that's her version. Her version is the shortest, but it's also, you know, that guy's look is just so haunting. It's very effective. After that, things go a little cuckoo. We go back to the rain soaked area. Once again, he's like, wow, yep, two versions of that story. Yeah, of course, the woman's going to say, you know, her version is that she was trying to fight back, but you never know. You know, this guy's a bastard, too. And they're like, I don't know how it comes up. They basically say something about, like, you're never going to get the truth from. Unless you can talk to the guy who was murdered. Like, well, they did talk to the guy who was murdered. Huh? Smash cut. We got a lady who's acting real crazy, and she's talking with the voice of a person speaking from a tin can. This actress is Minoru Chiaki. No, that's the priest. The medium is Noriko Hanma. And this actress is interesting because she is still alive and she's 106 years old.
Oh, wow. Whoa,
seriously? Wow.
Yeah.
She's older than Old Resident at Work by 3 years. Yeah. She's older than Kurosawa.
Yeah, I was trying to find if there was any news that she had passed away because they don't. Yeah, they just have her date of birth and it says that she's 106. So I think that she is. And she's just, like, completely out of the spotlight.
She's but, really, you know, she is really a medium. She's used her magic powers to stay alive all this time.
Ah, yes, of course. Now it all makes sense to me.
No, mm-hmm. I was wrong. She is, like, 5 months younger than Kurosawa.
She stole Kurosawa's soul.
Yeah, that's what kept her alive. She stole his youth and is continuing to live.
And she made him blind when he died. He is blind by the time he was dead.
Well, that's part
Spencer,
of the...
Spencer, stop depressing me.
Okay,
that's part of the soul stealing. That's part that's of the soul stealing.
That's why he quit making movies, because he couldn't see.
Yeah, she stole the souls through his eyeballs. It makes sense.
I'm just telling you the truth, Droll. He's dead.
He stopped making movies because he couldn't see? That's a lame excuse.
Yeah, like his vision kind of got real bad.
Whatever. Woody Allen still makes movies, and his eyes were clawed out, weren't they?
They should have been.
Oh. Yeah.
But yes, this medium is speaking in the voice of the dead samurai, and his version of the story is pretty twisted. You know, from what he tells, the rape happened, the assault. But afterwards, Toshiro is saying, hold on. I'm getting a little unclear on what actually goes on here.
This is a medium story?
Yes.
Yes, Tajimuro is so overcome with feelings for her that he basically says, you should come with me. Like, usually I take whatever I want, but after I've already taken you, I still want you more, so that must mean something. So you should come with me. And I have a ton of money from being a bandit, and I'll even give all that up if you don't want me to do that anymore. I'll work a normal job. Like he's doing all of this stuff. Like he is putting it out there, like, because he is so overcome with emotions for her, I guess. And then she's like, sure, I'll go wherever you want. But you have to kill my husband, because I would feel bad. If two men are alive who have been with me, I would feel terrible, or it would be a bad thing, which it just kind of made me groan a little bit.
That's right. Yeah.
And then
the way he's telling, the samurai is telling it, he's, you know, he's like, I was so shocked to hear these words coming out of her mouth. I couldn't believe it. And, she just starts yelling at, and Toshiro is also shocked that she would even say this. And she starts saying, kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him, over and over again. And, she's kind of hiding behind Toshiro's back, you know, pointing at this guy, like trying to push him in the direction of killing her husband. And it turns out that he is also disgusted by her just for even, you know, even trying to say that he should do this. So he pushes her to the ground and kind of he puts his foot on top of her, and he asks the samurai, "Do you want me to kill her or let her live? It's up to you at this point." And the samurai says, "At that second, I had so much respect for him, I forgave him in my mind for what he had done." And he, Toshiro's still asking, you know, like, "Do you want me to kill him?" And he moves, and she takes her chance to run off at that point. I believe he runs after her. And let's see, he comes back. Like, do they end up fighting again? Does he explain how he gets killed? I can't remember that. See, I'm once again.
No, he kills himself.
Yeah,
like, Toshimura comes back, frees him. And then the samurai just basically sits there for a very long period of time, and then he decides to kill himself with his wife's dagger.
And that's why he's in the cold, dark hell place or whatever, because he committed suicide.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is the one that paints her as, like, this... they've been doing it the whole time, except for... with the exception of her version of the story. But they've been painting her as kind of a gross person, but this one really paints her as, like, no, she is scum. Like, a man would not be able to stand by a woman like that, blah, 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 you know? It's really gross.
Yeah, I think that one, and then I know you're about to talk about the woodcutter's full story, but I think that one also goes the extra step of making her seem really awful as well.
Yeah,
it's in the woodcutter story where she basically says neither of them are men, because they should each be willing to kill the other, because of what's happened. Like, the husband, right. The samurai should be willing to kill the bandit because of what he did, and the bandit should be willing to kill the samurai in order to be with her because that's what he seems to want.
Yeah, in the woodcutter's version, they're all pretty culpable for what happens. It's not just her, or it's not just the bandit. It seems like the samurai is usually not responsible for anything until the last version of the story. After that's revealed, we go back to the rain-soaked place, and it's like, well, the words of a dead man obviously must have been telling the truth. And the woodcutter's like, no, they're still lying. They lied. Every single one of them was lying. It's like, well, how could you possibly know that unless you were there? And the woodcutter is guilty. He was there. He did not tell the police that he witnessed everything that had gone on. So the bandit plies him, and eventually he tells his version of the story, the last version we're going to get. And his version shows the same thing happened up to the point where Tajimura has taken advantage of the woman. And at this, he says, when I saw them, he was down on his knees begging her. And so he's saying, like, please, you have to, you know, you can be my wife. You have to be my wife. You have to come with me. You know, once I had you, I had to have you again. And she says, basically, like, I can't make the decision you're trying to tell me to make. I'm not going to decide to go with you. And she looks at her husband and says, aren't you my husband? Like, you're supposed to be defending me against this person like this. And she looks at him, looks at the bandit and says, and you're saying that you love me, but my husband is still alive right there. And it looks like you don't want to kill him. What kind of men are you? You know? And she takes the opportunity at one point to take her pearl-handled dagger and free her husband from his binds. And at that point, they have no choice but to smack at each other because they've both been shamed. Like, you can see that they both have this, like, shocked look on their face, like, oh, she's kind of right, you know. I guess we are supposed to do this? And so, unlike the first sword battle that we saw between the two, they at first are holding their weapons, and you can see that Tajimura is like visibly shaking. You can see the sword shaking in his hand as he's like kind of walking towards the samurai. And the samurai's got his sword out and he looks a bit steadier, but he also is not, you know, he's not rushing into it. They're both waiting for the other one to make a move. And when it finally happens, it turns into kind of a Three Stooges thing. They're slipping on leaves and their swords are getting stuck into the ground, and they're just running around each other over and over again, tripping over their own feet. It's, you know, it's, when it comes to samurai battles, this is embarrassing. And at the end, it looks like the samurai is almost going to win in this fight, because the Toshiro's bandit character has stuck his sword into the ground in a way that he lost it. So he's running around and the samurai keeps taking these swings at him. And I kept thinking about the video games I've played where, like, if you swing a sword in an arc, chances are you're going to hit something. But he keeps swinging I'm surprised he hits the air. he's doing a real bad job with his nice, super shiny sword. And so eventually they get to a point where Toshiro and him he's knocked his sword out of his hand. They're kind of wrestling on the ground. Toshiro is trying to crawl back to where his sword is. And the other guy's holding onto his leg, pulling, you know, doing a very ineffective pulling on him to not allow him to go forward. He does get his sword back. The samurai crawls back, cowering at Toshiro with his sword, who also still looks totally freaked out, but eventually decides that he has to end this and walks over and stabs the guy. When he does that, you hear the lady scream, shocked. You know, they're all shocked at what just happened, even though I don't know what other outcome there could have been, and she runs off. Toshiro runs after her, and eventually he comes back into the area without her, picks up the samurai's sword, you know, not knowing what else to do, and then runs off himself with that sword. There was a part when he was being interviewed that he said that he sold the sword that belonged to the samurai, so he at least was telling the truth about that. But yeah, that's his version of the tale. The woodcutter, that is.
Yeah.
Any comments on that one?
Well, I mean, I already sort of put a lot of my stuff out earlier, but I just to say again, I am still curious kind of which parts were embellished from the woodcutter's perspective, because it seems like he is a guy who values the truth, because he's you know, readily saying that all of these stories that are being told are lies, except for his, because he knows the truth. But as we've already talked about, you know, he is obviously setting things up in a certain way as well. He is obviously telling the story in a certain way, and he has his own sort of perspective and point of view on the story that he's trying to tell. So I am very curious which of these things is right. Is it a combination of all four? I'm assuming so. Are certain parts in his story more accurate than others, or are there certain parts of the samurai story that's more accurate? Like, I am very intrigued by this, and I think it's not just because of the movie, but it's just because of the structure. And I'm always like this with any sort of story that has these kinds of elements to it. Like, I'm always very intrigued by which of these things is right, because I believe that it's obviously a combination of all four stories. Each one has elements of truth in it. But I always find myself intrigued by which elements are the truth and which are not.
Yeah.
To me, this feels kind of like a Pulp Fiction type thing where to make more sense of it, you need to kind of like physically map out the different stories and like where they cross over and stuff.
And John Travolta got shot on a toilet.
Yeah.
Mm.
Or like Magnolia, like,
That happened before the movie begins, and so you just have to keep that in your mind as you're going through the film. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I was making some Pop-Tarts, and I think I still feel that the woodcutter's version would be the most truthful, only because he has the least reputation to lose in this. You know, the only outright lie he tells is a lie of omission, which we find out after this. The bandit and everybody, you know, we go back to the rain soaked area, and the bandit is, you know, a little overwhelmed by the story. The priest is still depressed. The woodcutter's depressed, whatever. And then all of a sudden they start to hear a baby crying. And the bandit immediately runs off and goes around to the other side of this structure.
Because he's going to eat the baby.
Yes. Yeah. And we hear this sickening chopping sound when he's chopping up the baby. And then he kills a turtle right on screen.
No. Hey.
I haven't seen Hannibal Holocaust. Yeah. I haven't seen Cannibal Holocaust.
It's not worth your time.
Hannibal Holocaust is when you watch it backwards.
Nice. And at the end, Anthony Hopkins says, "Did you enjoy that?" Yeah, but the bandit runs over, and the woodcutter and the priest run over to join him, but instead of getting the baby like you might think he was doing, since it's a helpless child, the bandit is stealing the clothes that the baby has been tucked into for protection. And the woodcutter immediately assaults him, like, why are you taking these things from this child? Like, this is an innocent child, and you're just stealing this clothes that it was obviously left in? And the bandit's defense, which is, I have to say, is absolute bullshit. It's like, well, the parents already abandoned him. How am I any worse than that? I'm like, well, we're not talking about the parents, buddy. Stop deflecting. Okay, you're the one stealing clothes from a baby. The woodcutter's like, you're a gross person. You're stealing from a baby. And the bandit says, yeah, well, I don't think I'm the only culpable person here. I don't know why you're making out to seem like I'm the worst person here. There's a part of your story that's missing, which is whatever happened to that pearl-handled knife, dagger. And basically, he's like, you stole it, right? To the woodcutter. And once the woodcutter is accused of this, he doesn't have a response because it's true. He saw that and he took it, and no one else had known what had happened to it. And in the bandit's mind, this makes him just as gross as he was when he was just stealing things from a baby. Now, I don't know if that's really the case. I don't. But, yeah, anyways, the priest picks up the baby, and the bandit basically takes off at this point. He's decided he's not, those other guys aren't very cool. You know, he wants to go hang out with his friends or whatever. I'm not sure. And I think the priest says something kind of mean to the woodcutter, like he can't stand like the way the humanity is being represented. He's kind of having a crisis of faith the whole movie, because he just wants to believe that there is good, that there is honesty. And at the end, the woodcutter says, I'll take the child if you're all right with that. I already have 6 children of my own. You know, another mouth to feed at this point is not going to make that much of a difference. And the priest apologizes for saying what he said. And that's basically the end of the movie there.
Yeah, the rain magically stops.
Even though people are dishonest, even though a terrible thing had happened that affected many people, even though a man who seemed like he was above reproach is also somebody who could do bad things, there is still good in the world.
Yeah. Like, I was reading something about the symbolism of the gate and how the gate is a physical symbol of an opening and a closing, and like initially it's kind of a closing where like humanity at its worst throughout the movie, and then the ending, it's on the other side of the gate and the rain stops and it ends on a hopeful note, where it's kind of open, like it's open to like, you know, hope and, you know, good things in the future.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful, Spencer.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I think that I've kind of laid out most of my thoughts on the movie. I did enjoy watching it. I mean, the performances are all really good. Like we already talked about, the camera work is great. And yeah, it's fun, and I like this storytelling structure and this format. I was going to ask you guys if you have, because this sort of style, the structure has been used in so many TV shows, mostly a few movies, but a lot of TV shows. I was going to ask if you had any that came to mind, like any particular episode of a show that came to mind that used this structure that you really liked. Because I do have one, but I was curious if you guys had any either.
I have one.
No, I don't got one. Go ahead.
Spencer, please, you're the host.
It was the X-Files one.
That's the one I was going to say. But which one? There were actually two.
There are two?
Yeah, there were two, apparently. Hmm. The one I'm thinking of I know very well, but the other one I didn't realize was also a Rashomon-style episode.
What's the other one?
Well, which one are you thinking of?
Bad Blood, the one with Luke Wilson as a vampire.
That's the one I'm thinking of, too. It's such a silly episode. Yeah. It's very atypical for the X-Files. When the X-Files decided to do comedy, they usually did a really good job at it because show is so self-serious. And when they decided to do a goofy episode like Bad Blood, it usually goes fairly well. The other episode that uses this structure is from season 3, Jose Chung's From Outer Space.
Oh yeah, I didn't even think of that using.
Yeah, which is when he interviews a bunch of abductees and witnesses and FBI agents at the scene of a potential alien abduction. But Bad Blood, yeah, that one's great. Basically,
and it was written by Vince Gilligan.
Oh, okay, that's right. Yeah. Joel, are you familiar with that episode?
I've only seen the first season of the X-Files, and that was recently. Okay. So,
this is from season 5. It's a vampire story, and basically, something bad happens, and Mulder and Scully have to they lay out their version of events. And it's really great to see how they view each other, because they have a very sort of skewed view of each other. And, it's a great, really funny episode. It's pretty great. And I was looking up a list of just other shows that, that used this sort of structure. Different Strokes had an episode, called Rashomon 2, which is a little pretentious maybe. It was about a burglary. Happy Days had an episode called Fonzie Gets Shot, where they provide differing accounts of how Fonzie is shot in the ass.
Okay.
Yeah. Dick Van Dyke had one. Frasier apparently had a couple. Everybody's Loves Raymond. MASH. Boomtown. ER. Veronica Mars. Smallville. Power Rangers. Magnum PI. Like, it seems like every television show has done a Rashomon episode. Star Trek Next Generation, Star Trek Voyager, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Like, it's great that, like, they're able to take this thing and just adapt it to so many different programs, because it's a really cool way of telling a story. And it's kind of crazy that there are all these various TV shows that can just take that and turn it into something.
Yeah, it seems like a device to use when they're like, oh fuck, we're running out of ideas.
That could be a thing. Like, it's a structure that works if you do it right, and it also it's kind of an interesting structure if you think about it, that it sort of eliminates continuity errors. Because if there is a continuity error, you just chalk that up to that's how that person remembered it. Like, I wonder if there probably has been. In fact, there has to have been a show that was of course, the show The Affair is essentially the entire series is basically a, or at least the first season. I haven't seen beyond the first season, but is basically a is Rashomon, because each character has their own perspective of the events that are occurring within that episode, and they're all telling their story with and characters are wearing different costumes in from are like different outfits from story to story. Their hair's different, their, you know, makeup's different, their even their just demeanor, how they carry themselves is all very different from perspective to perspective. And it's I haven't watched much of that show, but the few episodes that I watched, it was really interesting to kind of go through and pick out the differences from story to story.
There's some kung fu movie from maybe like 10 years ago that did that. I was trying to
Hero.
Yes, that's it. Where like each different version, they're wearing different colors. So, I think that's what it is.
Yeah, with jelly.
There is a lot written about Rashomon. I'm not a film expert by any stretch. But there is a lot written about that kind of did what we did, but in more academic detail. That's, some is real interesting, readable, some isn't. But, it's a fun road to go down, just looking up all the different perspectives on Rashomon. And it's been a while, but, Joel, our old buddy, Bosley Crowther, reviewed this movie for New York Times in 1951.
Tell me he loved it.
He did. It's the one that he loves.
Mm.
He praises pretty much everything about it. And every other Kurosawa movie after this, he either hated or thought was a John Ford ripoff.
Yeah. Well, he's a real sourpuss most of the time, seems like.
This is a very glowing review.
There you go.
And
so everybody who doesn't like this movie, you're full of shit.
Yeah, and the co-screenwriter, Shinobu Hashimoto, he co-wrote a lot of films with Kurosawa. Pretty much almost every movie Kurosawa did after Rashomon, he wrote with him, stopping at Kagemusha. And like pretty much all the ones before that, he had a hand in writing. And he even wrote the great Nakadai samurai movie, Sword of Doom, that we'll do at some point. I'm not sure when. Sword of Doom.
No, I heard that, and I didn't know what the first thing you said
Nakadai.
Was. Nakadai. You know, I should have been following the Wikipedia article. It actually lays out the story very well. So here's advice. If you're doing a podcast about Rashomon, look at the Wikipedia article.
Okay, yeah. That was it. But he wrote a lot of Kurosawa stuff, including Seven Samurai and Hand Fortress, and the awesome movie Sword of Doom.
Starring Frank Nakadai.
Sure.
I just saw in The Scandalous Adventures of Burakai.
We're going to cover that next year.
I didn't remember agreeing to that, but okay. It's a good movie.
I make the schedule. You don't.
Damn it.
Okay, so, we covered 1950 movies before. There's not much to pick from, really, for 1950.
Well, I was thinking maybe we could pick something that we haven't seen that actually sounds like something that would be interested.
Okay,
in seeing that. As right now, I was just looking at the list, and I've heard a lot about this movie, Gun Crazy. Joseph H. Lewis, let's see. Drama, crime, thriller. Yeah, I don't really know much about it, but I've heard it's one of the standout 1950 like violent crime movies. So it looks like there's all kinds of things that I need to catch up on.
Let's see. There's All About Eve, which I've only heard of but never actually seen.
Yeah.
I don't know much about it besides it's supposed to be very good, and that's about it.
Where the Sidewalk Ends, a film noir, which is probably based on the Shel Silverstein book.
Yeah. There is a if I remember correctly, in Shel Silverstein's book, there is a very leggy dame who needs help solving a crime.
Uh-huh.
Ooh. Oh, there's a dark city, but not the 90s one, a different one.
Yeah, there's a Broken Arrow, but not the 90s one, the 1950s. A different one.
The 90s was all about remaking films from the
1950s. Yep, seems like it. King Solomon's Mine, Alan Quatermain, inspiration for Indiana Jones.
Okay, there's a Spencer Tracy movie, Father of the Bride.
Nobody likes Spencer Tracy.
A lot of people do. He's great.
You keep bringing him up.
You should watch his movies.
He's not even a samurai.
So?
Mm.
He was a...
Untrue, actually. Spencer Tracy is a pretty well-respected, well-regarded samurai. He didn't do any films where he showed off his samurai skills, but he was an official samurai.
I mean, he killed those people with a sword in a writing desk, but I didn't think that was very samurai-like.
How do you think he got Katharine Hepburn?
He did Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in 1967. That was his last movie. Yeah. And it was completed just 17 days before his death in a samurai duel. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So he went out swinging. I mean.
Yeah. The duel's more important than getting that Oscar, which he won, by the way.
I mean, they gave it to him because he died by the sword. You know, die by the sword, live by the sword, get an Oscar. That's what they say.
Yeah. And, there's Asphalt Jungle, which I've always been curious about. Is that a Criterion?
I feel like it is.
I think I'd say on Filmstruck, but I don't remember.
Or Dancing Around Here.
Yeah, I know.
Did you not want to watch the Portrait of Madame, what's her name?
No, because that got in the way of the one-year anniversary episode that is going to be the movie High and Low. And I secured a... Well, we're going to have special guests on it, who are John Cribbs and Chris Funderburg from The Pink Smoke, a very good movie blog site with a lot of great writers, including John and Chris and Marcus Penn. And they will be actually in Delaware, and I'll record them in person.
I'm not invited.
You are invited.
Wait, I have a question. So if you guys do High and Low on your episode, once you talk about that, does that mean that you get sent back into the other dimension from which you came? I mean, once you kind of speak the name of your show and talk about the movie for which it's named, doesn't that send you back to the shadow world?
I got an arrangement worked out. I know a couple guys.
I think that just means we need to change the name of the podcast.
Oh, that's what it is.
Stray Dog, a Kurosawa podcast.
You guys are still going to do my idea, right? Where you're going to watch the films of...
I have a new film blog dedicated to Japanese cult and exploitation movies called Jailhouse 701, named after the films in the Female Prisoner Scorpion series. The first round of reviews will be the Rika trilogy, which is this really tonally weird girl gang movie that jumps between really upsetting and really goofy. It's a fun series. It's worth checking out. It's only on DVD because a lot of these movies are not streaming anywhere. You have to actually physically buy them. And I was on Grindhouse episode 74, Coonskin... Rough Actually's best movie. And I was on School of Schlock episode 26, Return of Kung Fu Dragon, about a kung fu movie that is kind of shitty but really interesting at the same time.
That was 100 years ago. Get on a new podcast. All right.
I'll be on your podcast.
You're not invited.
Well, you know what I'm going to bring up next.
No, what are you bringing up?
Baffled.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that movie. We can't do that. It's a TV movie. I told you we don't do TV movies.
Quentin's Quest, your favorite goddamn movie, a TV movie.
That's not a TV. That was in the theater. It made $1 million. There's nothing wrong with Fateful Findings. It was good.
Yeah, that's my favorite episode, when you guys are describing Neil Breen looking like a melted Birdman / David Duchovny. It made me laugh out loud so much that my client I was working with at the time had to check that I was okay.
Well, that's good to know. If you want to hear more laugh-em-ups like that, you can listen to Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, a weekly science fiction and fantasy movie that I do with my two co-hosts, Sarah and Aaron. This week, we are handling a 2017 movie, Logan, actually, to see if those claws feel real good or not. Actually, none of us had seen it yet, so I thought, like, hey, let's check this out. Why not?
And not even Aaron?
Nope, that was surprising, but he has an affinity for the comic book, apparently, so he avoided it. And I can't remember what the last thing we actually did was. Oh, yeah, Ex Machina from 2014.
That's a good episode. Favorite.
Yeah.
And a great movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And there's so much meat to talk about in that movie, you know, when it comes to the philosophical implications, like what institutes life and stuff like that. But there's also funny things to talk about. And if you haven't seen the movie, you should watch Ex Machina and then check out our episode on it.
It's been 3 years, so it's not a spoiler, but there's a great dance scene.
That is a spoiler, and you shouldn't spoil it.
Come on. You can watch it on YouTube. It's on there.
Yeah, you could watch it on YouTube the day the movie came out. Cut it out. Watch the movie.
Yeah, watch it.
Josh, plug your stuff, please.
I will do that. I co-host a show called PredictoCast, where we take a film that we know nothing about, watch the first 10 minutes, and then try to predict what comes next. We have a lot of fun over there. We watch a crazy diverse amount of movies. Right now in November, I don't know when this episode will actually drop, but we are currently in the midst of our month of thanks, where we are doing films suggested by our listeners. Spencer didn't get a slot this month because he suggested Dino King to us a couple of months ago, and he is now banned from giving us suggestions.
Well, nice. I picked it because it looked terrible. I thought it'd be funny.
It had some entertaining moments for sure. But next time, suggest us an actually good film, and I think that we will like it, because so far, all of the films that we've watched that our listeners have given us for this month have been really good and really worth watching. So, yeah, go over, check us out. We're available wherever you get podcasts, also at PredictoCast.com and on Twitter and Instagram at PredictoCast.
I want that to be my...
I guess that's okay.
I want that to be my apology pick.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I think that's totally fair. If you're both vouching for it and you both think that it's worth a watch, then I think we could work that into the show.
I'd like to pick Valerie and her Week of Wonders. No, wait, you already did that. Never mind.
That episode as of this recording, will come out tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's a really good movie.
It is really good.
It's a weird movie.
It's not weird.
Caroline was trying to pull the rug from under your feet, and it sounds like it worked.
She did, for sure. She did.
Do you know anything about the movie Daisies?
Oh.
I don't believe so.
That's not going that won't work for their format.
Do you really think
that's
so?
That's okay. Honestly, that's okay, because we kind of like when our format is broken a little bit. I mean, Valerie and Her Week of Wonders is a movie that doesn't really work for conventional film structure either, and we had some fun with it. We had some problems with it, but we had a lot of fun with that movie too.
You guys got to check out Daisies.
Yeah.
Or Branded the Kill. One of those two.
All right. Well, so Daisies and...
Branded the Kill.
Branded the Kill. And then
just do Good Morning and Daisies. Don't do Branded the Kill. Don't listen to him.
Okay.
Okay. What about Tokyo Drifter? That's fun.
That's an amazing movie.
Okay. I don't watch the Fast and the Furious movies. Sorry.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll suggest something way, you know, next year when you do this thing.
Yeah. All right. So next episode, next special episode will be on Studio Ghibli. We're going to watch My Neighbor Totoro. Yeah, My Neighbor Totoro.
My Neighbor Totes.
What were the other ones?
Grave of the Fireflies.
That. Do you want to do Whisper of the Heart or skip it?
Let's do Whisper of the Heart and Princess Mononoke. Let's do four of them.
Four. Okay. They are not streaming anywhere, so if you want to watch them, you have to like buy them or know someone who has them.
Yeah, you can go. I mean, there's a physical rental place out there. They are all basically readily available for purchase, but it is, you can probably find older DVD copies instead of having to buy the newer, Disney branded versions or whoever owns them right now. I don't think Disney owns them anymore.
They do. At Disney World, they still have a bunch of Ghibli stuff.
I would lend you my copy of Grave of the Fireflies, but after watching it the first time, I gave it to somebody because I didn't want it in my house anymore.
Well, you picked it.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to make you watch it.
Yeah, so I'll watch those somehow.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, so hey, Josh, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Josh.
Thanks for having me again, as always.
Yeah, if you want to come on for a third time, if you want to, you know, you can.
Okay.
But only a third time.
Thanks for that invitation.
You just have to kill someone, and then you can come again.
Yeah, that's, never mind.
Let's say kill a baby. And now I'm making my third phone call to the police.
Oh, no.
For yourself?
No.
Oh.
You guys just solicited me to commit murder.
Okay.
I mean, yes, I did have that Craigslist ad about being a hitman, but still, don't record it.
Yeah, can you take out Spencer for comparing me to Kevin Spacey? Thanks.
Okay. Oh, yeah, so Alfie to Zane, Bug Life, Knock and Die Forever, Chipmunk Cheeks Forever.
Pineapple Party, Watermelon Party. Some of those sound dirty, but they're not.
Bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show is available on the Google Play Store, Podiant, PODIANT, Podbean, as bean, not beam, and iTunes, and wherever you find your podcast. Thank you for listening.
But everybody's got pieces missing. And minimum, I like a little medicine. It make me feel like everything diminishing. The venom, the perhershing on my mellows. I'm continuing to fight against the sentiment that make me want to die. In a world full of uptight gentlemen, I want to find a boy spun like sweet cinnamon to grow some tennis. And what we take Benadryl to make my head a bit extra light.